Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman. Protest in Turkey after a Kurdish rights activist is killed. A prominent Kurdish lawyer and rights activist was shot in the head and killed in a street shootout in Turkey's troubled southeast Saturday. Much of the event captured on camera and broadcast around the world. The pro-Kurdish HDP party called the killing of Tahir Elci a planned assassination and urged people to protest. Prime Minister Davutoğlu said it was unclear whether Elci was caught in crossfire or assassinated. It was hours later when police fired tear gas and water cannon to disperse hundreds of people marching in Istanbul to protest against the killing. The marchers chanted shoulder to shoulder against fascism and Tahir Elci is immortal. Witnesses say Elci was shot by a single bullet after speaking to media in Diyarbakir, the largest city in Turkey's mainly Kurdish southeast, where he was president of the local bar association. A policeman was also killed in an ensuing exchange of gunfire. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan on Saturday voiced regret over Turkey's downing of a Russian warplane, saying his country was truly saddened by the incident and wished it had not occurred. It was the first expression of regret by the strongman leader since Tuesday's incident, in which a Turkish F-16 jet shot down the Russian jet on grounds that it had violated Turkey's airspace, despite repeated warnings to change course. It was the first time in half a century that a NATO member shot down a Russian plane and drew a harsh response from Moscow. Just in from the Associated Press, word that Vladimir Putin ordered sanctions against Turkey, including a ban on some goods. VOA News. Militants attacked a United Nations base in Kidal, northern Mali, early Saturday morning. Rocket fire killed two UN peacekeepers and a civilian contractor and injured 20 people, four of them seriously, according to a spokesman for the UN peacekeeping mission in Mali. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack, which followed a militant assault last week on a luxury hotel in Bamako that left at least 20 people dead. Two West African militant groups, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb and its affiliate Al-Morabitoun, claimed joint responsibility for the November 20th attack on the Radisson Blue Hotel. Friday, Malian forces arrested two men in connection with that hotel attack. Boko Haram extremists have claimed responsibility for a suicide bombing of a procession of hundreds of Shiite Muslims and threatened more attacks on opponents of its radical form of Islam. Shiite leaders said at least 21 people died in Friday's attack near Nigeria's northern city of Kano. Posting on social media Saturday as the West Africa province of the Islamic State, Boko Haram published a photograph identifying the bomber as Abu Suleiman al-Ansari. Egypt, Saturday, said there is a 90% chance that hidden chambers will be found within King Tut's tomb, based on the preliminary results of a new exploration of the 3,300-year-old mausoleum. Researchers say the discovery of a new chamber could shine new light on one of ancient Egypt's most turbulent times, and one prominent researcher has theorized that the remains of Queen Nefertiti might be inside. British Egyptologist Nicholas Reeves theorizes that Tutankhamun, better known as King Tut, who died at the age of 19, may have been rushed into an outer chamber of what was originally his wife's Nefertiti's tomb. Famed for her beauty, Nefertiti was the subject of a famous 33-year-old bust.
My close examination of these scans highlighted the apparent presence of closed doorways. On the west wall, potentially leading to an additional Tutankhamun period storeroom, labeled X in the cutaway bottom left here. And that on the north to a corridor continuation of the tomb, labeled Y. The proposal I put forward was that the burial of Tutankhamun was actually a tomb within a tomb.
This is the second find to be announced this week. On Tuesday, the Austrian Archaeological Institute discovered a giant fence dating back over 3,500 years at the site of another ancient capital city of Avaris. This announcement, which took place on Saturday, took place in the ancient city of Luxor. I'm Ira Melman, reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington. Pope Francis holds his first ever mass in Uganda during the second leg of his African tour.
He says the CDP believes in democracy, and what is important today is to reconcile all the Burkinabe.
Voters in Burkina Faso go to the polls on Sunday to choose a new president.
I had written to the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, who replied me 2 days ago. I had requested that a meeting between me and President Salva.
And Dr. Riek Machar, leader of the South Sudanese rebels, wants to meet President Salva Kiir for discussions. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Enormous crowds greeted Pope Francis in Uganda on Saturday as he delivered his first ever mass in the country during the second leg of his African tour. On Friday, Pope Francis praised Uganda for its outstanding response in welcoming refugees from other parts of Africa. For more, John Kakande, news editor at the New Vision newspaper, joins us live via telephone link from the capital, Kampala. Good evening, John.
Good evening, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. And how are you doing in Kampala?
We are fine. We are doing well.
Wonderful. The Pope is in Kampala or in Uganda in general. What's the highlight of his visit so far since he came or arrived yesterday from neighboring Kenya?
Right now, the Pope is meeting, is going to address the bishops and the other that leaders at the main cathedral for the Catholic Church in Kampala. But earlier on, he addressed the youth, also paid the homage to the martyrs, which was the main reason we came to the country, as far as we are concerned.
What was his message?
Yes.
What was his message specifically to the youth?
The youth, he was mainly focusing on the challenges they are facing. Two youth who gave their testimonies. One of them was born with HIV, and her parents died when she was 7 years. She has gone through a lot. So the Pope abandoned his speech to respond to these issues, and he was telling them not to despair, that they can always overcome adversity. But there is always a positive development, even where one believes that there is nothing that can come out. So he was trying to give them a message of hope, even when there is unemployment. People should not, the youth should not give up.
Now, John,
John,
talking about moral issues, a lot of human rights organizations have called on the Pope to talk about the issues of gays or lesbians who have been sometimes attacked in Uganda and all that. Was there any hint of him talking about the respect of human rights and of such nature?
No, that didn't come up. It hasn't come up in all the speeches he has given, at this one yesterday at the State House, that one, the two he has made today, that hasn't come up at all. And actually, when he was talking to the youth, he also mentioned the issue of marriage, that is something they should value a lot and look forward to. Probably the Pope knows is a very sensitive issue here, and nobody has brought it up.
What has been the reaction of Ugandans so far?
Oh, the country is in celebrations hosting the third Pope. And you know, this has been long pending for a long time. So eventually, when it has happened, not only the Catholics, but all the other leaders from the other Christian leaders, and even the Muslims have been very excited. And indeed, we could see the excitement even at the Mater Shrine, at the youth. This is also registered a home for the elderly just about 1 hour ago. And everywhere I have been on the streets, people have been lining up to see him, and they are extremely delighted.
Now, John, the presidential candidates, 8 of them, agreed unanimously to temporarily suspend their presidential campaign as he is in the country, or as the country welcomes the Pope and hosts him. Has the Pope hinted about the need for a peaceful election ahead of or a peaceful campaign ahead of next year's vote?
Not the election. In his speech at State House, he did to leaders, leading in the armed manner, and also ensuring that resources are distributed equitably among all the people, also the concern for the poor. But one interesting bit is that when the president stand up at the shrine, Catholic Mater Shrine, for the Holy Mass, his two main challengers, that is the former Prime Minister Mahabazi and his former physician, basically, were also there. So, for the first time in over a decade, he had a handshake with the party in Turkey.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. We apologize for the rather poor nature of the phone lines. John Kakande is the news editor at the New Vision newspaper. He joined us live from Kampala. Turning to West Africa, Burkina Faso holds elections for a new president and parliamentary Sunday, just over a year after mass protests ousted longtime leader Blaise Compaoré. It has been a tumultuous transition at times. Elections had to be postponed last month after a failed coup. Now, as Emily Eob reports for VOA from the capital Ouagadougou, Burkinabe say it is time for a fresh start.
Politicians in Burkina Faso are in the home stretch ahead of general elections Sunday. A first-round knockout, shouts an entertainer from a double-decker truck in the streets of Ouagadougou. The truck is filled with orange-dressed supporters waving posters of candidate Roch-Marc Christian Kabore, a frontrunner. Supporter Amadou Sinare waves at passers-by.
Parmi tous les 14 candidats, on a vu, il est le seul à avoir le meilleur programme.
Sinare says he supports Kabore because he has the best program of all candidates in terms of health and employment. The truck passes the burned-out headquarters of the CDP, the former ruling party under President Blaise Compaoré. Mass protests ousted Compaoré in October 2014 when he tried to change the constitution to extend his already 27-year rule. Kabore was a longtime Compaoré ally and cabinet member, but left the president's side last year. Transitional authorities have barred anyone who supported Compaoré's effort to change the constitution from running. The CDP does not have a presidential candidate on the ballot. Watching Kabore's truck pass, however, CDP supporter Mathias Ouedraogo says they aren't sitting on the sidelines.
Je pense qu'on reste démocrate, c'est que l'enjeu majeur aujourd'hui c'est d'avoir réconcilié.
He says the CDP believes in democracy and what is important today is to reconcile all the Burkinabe. He says the priority of the party is the parliamentary election also happening Sunday. Kabore's main challenger is longtime opposition figure Zéphirin Diabré. At a rally in a stadium in Ouagadougou, Diabré say Kabore's program looks just like Compaoré's.
Vous voulez aller de l'avant ou aller en arrière?
You want to move forward or go backward, he said. Do you want a true change or fake change? 12 other candidates, including 2 women, are running. Another frontrunner among them is Benewende Sankara, who says he is the political heir of former president and national icon Thomas Sankara, killed during the coup that brought Compaoré to power. political debates are popping up on TV and across town as voting day approaches. At a meeting at the University of Ouagadougou, people got up on stage and addressed the crowd of students, many of whom will vote for the first time Sunday.
Nous avons une chance historique. C'est celle où les masses populaires vont dompter les politiques.
One speaker said they have a historic opportunity during which the popular masses will tame the politicians and make them respect the people's will, he says. Students said they want the momentum for change to continue.
On a tant entendu ça. La veille des élections, vraiment, ça laisse vraiment des frissons.
25-year-old Bertin Tendrebiogo says they have been waiting for this for so long that it is thrilling as voting day gets closer. This is a risky election, he says, and they are impatient, but they pray everything will go well. Security would be tight for the poll, with 25,000 security personnel deployed around the country. Analysts say a second-round presidential runoff is likely. Emilia from VOA News in Ouagadougou.
Meanwhile, the Economic Community of West African State, ECOWAS, says Manuel Serifo Namajo, the former president of the transition in Guinea-Bissau, will lead the group's poll observer team to monitor the presidential election in Burkina Faso scheduled for Sunday. 14 presidential candidates will be participating in Sunday's vote. Dr. Remy Ajibewa, the ECOWAS Director for Political Affairs, told me that members of the group will be deployed throughout the country to observe and monitor all operations ahead of Sunday's presidential vote.
It's part of the ECOWAS supplementary protocol that says ECOWAS, as a matter of like a mandate, they are to send observers to ensure that they monitor the process of the election. Not only during that election, before the election, they will have also sent what we call a fact-finding mission to ensure the preparedness of that country. And in any way that there's some shortcomings, they will readdress. But for this time around, ECOWAS will be sending 133 short-term observers and 13 long-term observers to monitor the entire electoral process and the election in that constituency, as well as all the region.
Why the special emphasis on Burkina Faso? Burkinabes themselves appear to want to ensure democratic tenets in the country after kicking out former President Blaise Compaoré, who wanted to extend his term and couldn't, but had to run into exile.
It's not particularly related to Burkina Faso alone. Likewise, the elections that we've been having over the last 15 years, every time we send even more than 130. For example, in the case of Nigeria, we sent 300 observers. We also sent 22 long-term observers. In the case of Togo, we sent 80 observers short-term, and then we sent 14 long-term. But the reason why we are sending observation mission, as I've said, to give authenticity, because outside international community believes what ECOWAS says concerning the election, to a considerable extent, have always been what the other international observers always agree. Because in terms of numbers, we do send the largest number compared to EU, compared to African Union, compared to OIF, compared to any other organization. So it's on the basis of that that it has been part of our, let me say, mandate of sending observers there.
Dr. Ajibewa, is there a cooperation or a help that ECOWAS will give to the Electoral Commission in Burkina Faso in an effort to ensure transparency, free, fair, and credible election?
As you rightly said, we do give financial package to member states. We also provide technical assistance. In the case of Burkina Faso, we're giving some financial assistance to the National Electoral Commission. We also send technical advisors to help ensure that the voters' list is done in a way that will not cause problems among the political parties. Because we tend to believe that oppositions, more often than not, tells us that it's not only when the election is on that the rigging is done, but it will have been done earlier. So against that background, that's why we have what we call the long-term observers. Long-term observers have been on the ground for long, and they are to ensure that they also help, assist in the technical way. Also, we sent some technical advisors to help with the electoral process in terms of the voters' registration, voters' list, and to modify any areas that needs to be readdressed.
There are critics who say that it seems African observer missions usually have preconceived, written down statement approving the election irrespective of voter tampering and voter irregularities. What is going to be different with this specific group of delegates that you are sending to go and observe this election in Burkina Faso?
I quite disagree with that notion that there is usually a prepared statement. But going by the fact of Nigerian case, you will see that a sitting president was ousted and ECOWAS was able to even tell that it was free and credible. And if you look at it, more often than not, you look at our statement, we go by what happened at that particular time that we've seen it. That is to say, what we observe from the field through our observers. So at no time do we have any preconceived idea or notion that someone will win. For this particular case, in the case of Burkina Faso, that's why we have the long-term observers.
Dr. Remy Ajibewa is the ECOWAS Director for Political Affairs. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. The leader of the SPLM in opposition says he wants to meet South Sudanese President Salva Kiir to discuss issues about the security of the advance team of the SPLM in opposition scheduled to visit Juba. Dr. Riek Machar says his advance team will not travel to Juba if the government continues to attack his troops in eastern Equatorial State. Machar says he is ready to implement the peace deal but wants assurance from President Kiir that Juba is safe.
We support the fact that the JMAC, that is the Joint Monitoring Evaluation Commission, be launched, okay? We have total support to the JMAC. We want the chairman of the JMAC to assume his responsibilities. But then, unfortunately, the timing was not coordinated. The venue was not agreed. So, and it got us, we're still having meetings arranging our advance party that is going to Juba. You know that we have publicly announced that we are sending 500 of our members to Juba. We are in the process. We had just finished today naming our members who are members of the advance party.
JMAC and IGAD saying that they had written to you in advance informing you about the developments that are happening in Juba, the launching of the JMAC and the returning of the former detainees, and they were expecting you to be part of the team in Juba, or rather your group to be part of the team in Juba.
That was 4 days ago. We learned of it. We got an invitation to two of our members. As you know, that we were represented by two high-ranking members of our movement. And, you know, we have no presence in Juba. We have not yet broken the ice of what is happening in Juba. I had written to the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, who replied me 2 days ago. I had requested that a meeting between me and President Salva be arranged. Because since we signed the agreement separately, you know, I signed on the 17th of August and he signed 9 days later. We have not met. There are issues that we need to discuss between us. And then I send my advance party, I come and assure my advance team that things are all right. They can go ahead before I join them. This has not happened. Instead, I was told such a meeting should only take place in Juba. I think the people forget that there has been a very serious war, and that there is a lot of violations. 3 days ago, our assembly area was attacked, air raid by the government, where they killed 23 people, including two brigadier generals. It's not a simple thing. We are for peace.
Correct me if I'm wrong. It sounds like your group is not certain about their security if they go to Juba. Is that right?
That is true. These are the issues that I want to discuss, nitty-gritty issues. President and his first vice president to discuss. Because how do I send that big number of people without the president assuring me that things are all right when his air force is bombarding our assembly areas? You know that? The containment areas.
Is there any reasons for South Sudanese to believe that you are ready to implement this peace agreement?
I just want to tell you, we have now composed our advanced team. We have been sitting for the last 2 weeks organizing ourselves and selecting our advanced team. They are ready to go to Juba.
Dr. Riek Machar is the leader of SPLM in opposition. He spoke with John Tanza of South Sudan in Focus from Pagak, South Sudan. The Tanzanian president has issued a raft of instructions to curb government spending. John Magufuli, who took office on November 5, has implemented a series of austerity steps, including cancelling Independence Day festivities and restricting foreign travel by officials. Chabi Barasa is a journalist with the Daily News. My colleague Douglas Impoga reached him in Dar es Salaam by phone and asked him whether there is a noticeable change in the style of leadership between Mr. Magufuli and his predecessors.
There have been notable changes. This is the president who has hit the ground running, because only the second day after he was sworn in, he went to the treasury. He walked on foot, actually, to the treasury, and that witnessed for himself how the treasury is doing its work. And from the moment he visited the treasury, he has set the tempo that is sustained until the latest, I'll call it another episode, which happened on Friday, that is yesterday, when he suspended the TRA commissioner following the loss of some containers at our airport. So this is the president who has already distinguished himself from his predecessors.
Since Mr. Magufuli took office on November 5th, he has so far implemented a series of austere steps, including cancelling the Independence Day festivities and restricting foreign travel by officials. How are these measures received by the people in Tanzania?
Yeah, this is a very welcome move. Actually, it's a whiff of fresh air to the masses here, because people have for long been pointing accusing fingers at the officials for lavish lifestyles and also for spending huge sums of money to stage these events like the Independence Celebration, where there are parades and so on and so forth. And this time we are being told that instead of going to the National Stadium to celebrate our Independence Day, we will be involved in the other more productive activities such as cleanliness and other issues.
When he was campaigning for presidency, he pledged to fight corruption. What has he done in that direction to make sure that he fulfills that promise?
When he inaugurating the parliament some few days ago, he made it very clear once again that he will be very, very strict and he will have no mercy on corrupt officials. So the latest step was taken is to suspend the Commissioner General of the Tanzania Revenue Authority. It only happened yesterday. So he suspended him following disappearance, in inverted commas, of more than 300 containers from the Dar es Salaam port. Yeah, he's shown that he means what he says. He's walking the talk as far as fighting against corruption, yeah.
Chabi Barasa is a journalist with the Tanzanian newspaper, The Daily News. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Dar es Salaam. You are listening to Nightline Africa from the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent, then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
If I dance, she go dance. And if I move, she go move.
Baby mama,
if I dance,
I like you like that.
Mama, she go dance.
I like you like that.
And if I move, say she go move.
Yo, Take the lead. And I know they complain. We go to the front page.
Baby, always love.
Shake body. Shake body. Shake body. Shake body.
Your eyes, oh, yeah, oh, I love you.
From the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for our Saturday commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a pleasure for me to look at U.S. policy towards Africa. At the same time, every week I pay close attention to African opinions on and attitude toward the United States. This week, a number of developments pertaining to U.S. policy towards Africa and African attitude toward the United States are relevant. Let me just say the U.S. government is still concerned about terrorist activities against U.S. nationals or properties anywhere around the world. At the same time, there is great concern about how terrorist activities affect U.S. relations with other peoples around the planet. This week, the most important development which concerns U.S. leadership is how peace and security can be maintained in African countries, especially when U.S. government is involved in big matters. The Pope came to the United States just some months ago, and successfully he was received with great honor by many Americans, particularly American Catholics and other people in the United States. So naturally, the papal message is going to Africa this time around. So naturally, all those people who are looking at U.S.-American relations will be watching developments in Kenya, in Uganda, in Central Africa. These are key developments for Africans, because the African people are welcoming leaders around the world, secular or religious. So when we look at the papal visit to Africa, you listen very carefully to how some of the spiritual leaders are addressing the human condition and how these problems affect all human beings today. From the papal statement in Kenya, in Uganda, you can see that the U.S. government is very much concerned about the same issues as the Pope, who is a spiritual leader. But President Obama, who visited Kenya recently, grappled with some of the same issues Africans are facing. The whole question of what are we going to do for young people? What is the future of these young people? President Obama was very much concerned about the African youth, and you do have programs now linking African youths and the United States. And this youth program, which is an important development during the Obama administration, an issue which has been very central in the papal statement to the kids, particularly in Kenya, where the president visited not long ago, African youth and the future of the United States. Because here again, history plays a very important role, because you see, during the time of President Kennedy, the Peace Corps volunteers attracted the attention of many young Americans and even the older ones, as history revealed, because the mother of President Carter from Georgia traveled all the way to India to the veteran services. There are thousands of Americans who went overseas to contribute to human development. So the papal visit to Kenya and the visit of President Obama to Kenya are very historical, because the Kennedy administration touched young people around the world and many older people, because the human beings were facing the question of development. Development. This becomes very important today. So when you talk about U.S. policy towards Africa, the memories of John F. Kennedy comes back to life. He was dealing with young people, and all of us who are now living today in our 80s and 60s, or even 50s as young people, remember those days. So when the Pope went to Kenya, you see President Uhuru Kenyatta, who was not even born when that time was coming along. Because you see, when the Kennedy administration came in, Kenya was not yet independent. Lo and behold, history in its own way of making history. Uhuru Kenyatta will now be the president of Kenya, following the footsteps of his father. And he carried the name of freedom, which was a very important moment at the time of human history. And that's the way it is today.
Thank you, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Nelson Lopez, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the noise of the frogs does not stop the elephant from drinking water. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Third Committee of the UN General Assembly, which deals with social, humanitarian, and cultural issues, has adopted a resolution expressing serious concern over human rights violations in Iran. The resolution, sponsored by Canada and co-sponsored by the United States and 41 other countries, passed with a vote of 76 in favor, 35 against, and 68 abstentions. A vote on the measure before the entire General Assembly, like similar ones on North Korea and Syria, is expected in December. The resolution on Iran was adopted after the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Iran, Ahmed Shahid, submitted his latest report to the UN, in which he called attention, among other issues, to the country's disturbing spike in executions. In the first 9 months of this year alone, more than 690, the highest per capita rate in the world. The resolution adopted by the Third Committee expressed serious concern over what it called the alarmingly high frequency of and increase in the carrying out of the death penalty, in disregard of internationally recognized safeguards, including executions undertaken without notification to the prisoner's family members or legal counsel. The resolution also urged the Iranian government to end widespread and serious restrictions on freedom of expression, opinion, association, and peaceful assembly, to release individuals arbitrarily detained for the practice of these rights, to eliminate in law and practice violations against women and girls, to end restrictions on the right to freedom of thought, conscience, religion, or belief, and to stop the persecution of members of religious minorities. In addition, among other matters, the UN called on Iran to address the poor conditions in its prisons, to eliminate the practice of denying medical care to prisoners, and to end the continued and sustained house arrest of leading opposition figures from the 2009 presidential elections. During Iranian President Hassan Rouhani's campaign in 2013, he pledged to improve the human rights situation in Iran. Tragically, this pledge remains unfulfilled. The United States, as U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, said in a statement after the adoption of the resolution, remains deeply concerned about the human rights conditions in Iran and will continue to engage internationally and speak out forcefully in support of the fundamental rights of the Iranian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.